This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, Susan Campbell will join us to continue our series on homelessness in Connecticut. She's been following the 100-day challenge in Greater Hartford. We'll talk specifically about one of the challenges, getting identification for people who have no home. But first, new patterns of extreme weather have insurance companies thinking seriously about climate change. Storms intensify, damages increase. Many are looking at new ways to predict losses from climate-related risks. We'll look more closely today at how global warming is affecting insurers, how the insurance industry's role in mitigating the effects of climate change is really quite important, and we'll also consider what this all means right here in Connecticut, home to the insurance capital of the world. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Joseph McDougald. He's a professor in residence and executive director for the Center for Energy and Environmental Law at the UConn School of Law. Welcome to the program, Joe.
Thank you very much.
And Peter Kochenberger is associate clinical professor of law and executive director of the Insurance Law Center at the UConn School of Law. Thank you for coming in, Peter. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let's just set the groundwork for our conversation here. Why does climate change matter so much to insurers? I'll let you go first.
All right. Thank you. Two things. One, as large companies, insurers like banks and many others, they have large amounts of money to invest. And so how they invest it and how those investments can be affected by climate change and loss is important. But this major issue is that insurers also insure against climate change, either directly, typically indirectly, such as homeowners insurance. The loss, if there are more losses, which it's certainly anticipated to be on the shore or in any area where there's increased risk, increased natural disasters, then insurers will be paying more in losses and we'll all be paying more in premiums. So insurers not only are concerned as any company are about climate change, but also because it directly affects their business. This is largely property casualty insurers.
Yeah.
I think there's also been a big change. The Supreme Court stepped into climate change, and I don't know that most people realize it. They've been talking about it now year after year, and a big part of that has been that one question's been answered. Insurers were worried initially when if you're insured coal-fired power plants that people affected by climate change were going to engage in tobacco-type litigation. The court's been pretty clear in a combination of a state court, that's not going to happen. The Clean Air Act is how we're dealing with it. So now insurers are worried about the broad number of things. Homeowners, insuring professional liability insurance for architects. What if you don't take account of it? Crop loss. I was in a meeting some time ago with people from Nestle that are worried about their supply of sweet water. That's a category of water they use nationally. And they're talking about how that affects both their business, but they're talking about their risk. Risk always turns into insurance. It's been fascinating the number of broad meetings I've been to where people end their conversation saying, and what about insurance? I'll tell you, Peter and I held a conference in 2012 on climate change and insurance, and I think we were very surprised. We had people flying in from across the globe to talk about this. This had been a topic before the 2008 economic meltdown. The world went quiet, but the insurance companies behind the scenes have been working on it constantly. They hire climatologists. They hire modelers. It's a very big effort that I don't think most people talk about.
Well, has it changed a lot in the last couple of years? Has something ramped up? Because, you know, as I talked about at the very top of the show, we've been mapping the public's perceptions around climate change and how after this spike around Al Gore's movie and a lot of attention paid to polar bears floating away on icebergs, that the American public seemingly over the course of the last couple of years has gotten a little less interested in climate change as a political issue and, frankly, a little bit less believing even of climate change as a man-made event. This is something that we're all kind of working on and thinking about. Meanwhile, it seems like the business community, the insurance company, is moving in the opposite direction, right?
Yes. I mean, I don't think there's been a dramatic event from an insurance perspective in climate change in terms of how they've been approaching it. And while it's in some kinds it's a favorable story, there's an entity called CERES, C-E-R-E-S, which works in the environmental area and encourages firms to invest appropriately. They have probably been the primary monitor of how insurers are looking at climate change. And they've issued a series of reports from 2009 to last year, which are actually fairly critical of insurers, although they note that there's some improvement. But one of the difficulties is this is their public face of how insurers are doing. And there's a dramatic difference in Europe, between insurers and how they talk about climate change and in the United States.
No, that's fascinating. Tell us a little bit more about that. You're saying in Europe, insurance companies are not just, you know, trying to do the work behind the scenes and trying to make sure that they're mitigating risk, but they're actually going out in front saying, you know, this is real. This is something that we needed to be talking about.
Absolutely. You go on there, go on the web pages of the major European insurers like Zurich or Munich Reinsurance, some of the Swiss Reinsurance. And if it's not on the front page of the website, you'll see it very, you know, within one click away. And in contrast, you go to State Farm. State Farm is the largest insurance company in the United States. It insures roughly 20 to 25% of the homes, which means they're more concerned about climate change than probably any other insurer in the country. And you can't find climate change on there.
Hold on. So why is that? Why is State Farm saying, like, climate change doesn't really exist? We care about it, but we don't want to, you know, talk about it out in the public.
You know, to the point you're making a little bit, I show two charts when I teach climate law to my students. I love this. One is a chart of the number of news stories that the major media groups cover on climate change. And you see a spike right before Waxman-Markey came out. You know, a lot of it comes out. I have these great charts that split how many of them are saying there's an issue versus how many aren't. But then you put out a chart by Swiss Re that goes not up and down. I know I'm on radio. I'm waving my arms,
yeah.
But there's a chart that shows from them how they view the climate-enhanced damages they pay. And that's just a straight line up and growing further. So on the one hand, it's nice for us. We cover it back and forth. But the reality is the insurers know it's getting more expensive every year as it comes up. And they're regulating for it. They're looking for it. One of the things that really is intriguing is the amount of private work they're doing. And I think that's very easy for an insurance company to say, I don't want to get into the policy on it, but their job is money. It's a portfolio, and they're taking it extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the American companies, though, from the survey you were talking about before that did pretty well just down the street from us, the Hartford, you think about some of these big companies, maybe they're doing a little bit better talking about climate change. They've got shareholders, and shareholders are pretty sophisticated, and they want to make sure that they're, you know, they're investing in a company that actually gets what's going on, right?
Absolutely, and the issue in part is it's sort of what you were talking about earlier, the perception of climate change in the United States versus other countries. I mean, State Farm has to be concerned about climate change, and I doubt very much it doesn't believe it. Its business is to look at reality, but they have made a decision. Not to talk about it, not to engage publicly their policyholders. Very different decision than other insurers. And companies like the Hartford and Travelers as well, they're more public. They're not – you won't see the amount of public work and public discussion with the Hartford and Travelers that you might see in Europe, but you'll see it far more than you will with a lot of other companies.
John, I'd like to challenge the idea that it's – while there was clearly at the time of ClimateGate and all that, there was a giant falling off. I've sensed that the public perception in the last 24 months or longer has really come up. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, after Hurricane Sandy, as you probably know, Connecticut engaged, Representative Albus down in East Haven formed the Shoreline Preservation Task Force. I went to a meeting in the Brantford Library, and I love this. I was sitting in the back, told my wife I'd only be gone a few minutes, and I'm in there, and the room was full. And what were people saying? Hey, climate change and sea level rise is real. What are you, state officials, going to do to protect us? Mm. As someone who reads in this area, it was a remarkable story. So regionally here, there's not a lot of trouble engaging people.
But I think that's one of the questions. So insurance, especially big insurance companies, and that's really what we have here in America, they're looking at a global marketplace and they're looking at a global problem. But it really is, I think, in pockets, right, much more important to people. Along the shoreline in Brantford, they do care about climate change because they see the effects of sea level rise. They see the effects of worse storms. Middle of the country, maybe there's not as much interest in that. I mean, how much does that play into the business that insurers have? Because if you just have pockets of interest in climate change, it's a little different than if you have the entire country saying, we need to do something about this.
Well, it's a great case to look at Connecticut because there are two things about the Northeast. One, if you look at the incidence of big storm events, forget your opinion on climate change or what will happen in the future. The distance of time between 100-year and 500-year events over the last 60 years has decreased, meaning they've become more frequent, by 22%. So whatever policies we come up, whatever our people look for, it's very real to them for what we're doing. The other part is because of our structure, which is hyper-local and so much. I'm the chairman of my board of finance in Madison. I was a selectman during the storms. The coastal areas are so important. Both they garner a large part of the town budget, and the very active populace tend to be very big groups. You listen to them very carefully, and they're worried about their protection of the areas, and you're worried about the coastal resources because that's what powers the towns.
But you bring, I mean, it's an great point because while it's certainly located in some areas more, particularly the coast, the effects of climate change can be quite dramatic elsewhere. I mean, if increasingly it's going to be hot and perhaps dry in much of the Midwest, that obviously has a tremendous negative effect on food supply, price, and those issues. But insurers sometimes, crop insurance, which is a federal program, that affects them as well because, as Joe was mentioning, when there's risk, there's often insurance. So it's an area they have to look at.
Maybe just look at the drought in California right now. Our food prices here in Connecticut are going up right now. So what role does the insurance industry have to play in all that? I mean, you think about it. I'm a small business person in Connecticut, and I'm trying to sell products that I get from a place that can't grow food the way they used to grow it. I mean, that does cause a problem for me here. What's the insurance world's role in all this?
Well, no, that's a great – right. So it's in that area, it's going to be – it would be very indirect. So insurance – what insurance can do is if you allow it – and there's reasons why you may not want to – if you allow insurance to evaluate and charge the full extent of the risk – then you're going to encourage good behavior or socially desirable behavior. And the best example outside of climate change, we all know, why don't we speed in our car? Well, it might be dangerous. We can get a ticket. But also because if we get a ticket, our insurance rates go way up. So, insurance, in a sense, is a private regulator. It helps govern our behavior by giving us incentives, lower insurance, to act in a socially desirable way. If right now, if the purchase homeowner's insurance on on the shoreline, there can be a subsidy for that, and that the homeowner is not paying the full cost. That's a public policy decision, but it means in some ways it encourages people to live in areas that they otherwise couldn't afford. The other side of that is if you don't have some subsidy, then you are leaving the shoreline to the wealthy, which to some extent it already is. So how insurers can price risk can really encourage programs like risk mitigation, the move away from the shore.
Well, and we're going to be talking about that in the next segment as we bring in somebody else who's working along shoreline issues and where we build. But I think this is a big part of it. How can the insurance industry, aside from just deciding to talk about it more publicly, how can it actually change behaviors? I mean, what are some things that you think that maybe insurers could even start to do more that would start to get us to think, change behaviors, and get us moving in the right direction around mitigating some climate change problems?
Well, the hard problem is that we started in the 60s to subsidize flood insurance, and that's how we developed so much of people in different areas. That was a problem during Hurricane Katrina. A lot of displaced people had construction around that time. There was a bill put out, and Peter can talk about this part, Brigard Waters, that said it should now flood to the rate of your insurance should now tie to the value of your home. And it doesn't. It's very heavily subsidized. It went $25 billion into the hole last year. So it's a big deal. They're trying to find the way to move those rates. Remember, the policy was put in place back when the world was relatively static. There was no sea level rise that we were paying attention to. There's certainly no acceleration. It's a policy that was created before a climate-changing world, and it's now responding to a climate-changing world. And how we start to change those rates to change behavior in a way that's still fair. A lot of communities are, we think of coastal communities being very wealthy. If you look up and down the shoreline in Connecticut, that's not true uniformly.
Right.
How do you avoid, a social injustice, but at the same time tying new construction and value to the value it should have? Insurers are very good at this, to their credit, right? They insure a lot of complicated products, and they're going to have to engage in it. But the federal government's the biggest player in the way right now.
Yeah, flood insurance rates increased for about 1 million Americans just yesterday, as a matter of fact, on April 1st. Can you just, before we take our first break, you just talk a little bit about flood insurance? Because this is a very important, murky thing, something certainly, whether it's Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina, the idea of what Americans are actually insured for has become, well, a vitally important issue, and we have to think about it moving forward.
Right. And so, you know, in brief, so there are homeowners policies do not – almost always do not cover flood insurance. Do not cover flood, the loss of flood. So there's been a federal program, as Joe mentioned, the National Flood Insurance Plan. It's administered by private insurers, like including Travelers and Hartford and others, but it is ultimately funded by the federal government. And it was never designed to be fully accurate. It was designed to be a compromise between, you know, insuring against flood and affordability. That program went as tremendous debt after Katrina and then especially Storm Sandy as well. And so in 2012, there was an act of law called Biggert Waters that would have modified the flood insurance plan and dramatically increased prices over the years. Well, as it passed, not much attention. Within a year or two, as we came much closer to those rates coming in, there was a tremendous outcry. And what we have is it's the Homeowners Protection Act of 2014, which essentially rolls back many of those rates. So even though, yes, as of yesterday, flood insurance rates are increasing, it is a much smaller increase than it otherwise would have been. So the good thing is that makes it more affordable. It maintains some affordability. The bad thing is that it doesn't it means we as a country are subsidizing homeowners and businesses who live on the shore. So if your rates are not mathematically accurate, if you're not allowed to price insurance to take into effect the cost of the risk, then there's a subsidy. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but it means gets to your point, John, in which so yes, people in Montana, Idaho, and Mansfield, Connecticut, where I live, subsidize to some extent the people and businesses who are on the shore through our taxes. And that's an okay public policy, but it has pros and cons.
We're going to do one quick phone call, and if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Ben is calling from Stonington. Is this Ben Duvall?
Sure is, John. How are you?
Hey, Ben, good to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm sorry I didn't hear the guest comment on flood insurance, but it is a huge issue that local officials are just sticking their head in the sand about. They really are. Down here in Stonington, we tried to get the local, FEMA folks to come down or state FEMA folks, and it kept getting pushed off and pushed off. And I'm not saying there's any nefarious reasons. It just did. The fact is, in a lot of these communities, for example, if you buy a house, of course, you need to have flood insurance. And the house I was renting before, if I had bought the house, it would have been $40,000 a year through USAA, $40,000. I mean, I have the paperwork, okay? And which is, you can't do that. So the house did sell. It sold to someone who wrote a check for $350,000. Thus, they didn't need to get flood insurance. The problem is, though, there's multiple problems. If that person's house goes down, right, they're not going to get reimbursed, of course, because they don't have flood insurance. But they can't build that house the way it is with FEMA rules. They're going to have it jacked up. And in the borough of Stonington, you couldn't jack it up because of zoning regulations. And then people say, well, just go to court. Well, that's never going to happen. So the other problem is a lot of these homes along the coast that are impacted with this flood insurance, which I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent. I'm just saying the value of those homes is going to drop. And then where are you going to make up the property tax? Because those are all really valuable. Nobody's talking about that.
Hey, Ben, thank you very much for the phone call. And that's one of the really important things. We're having this big global conversation, this national conversation. And Joe, here we're talking about local town government, local zoning ordinances, the property tax base so the town of Stonington can actually survive. And these are really important issues that maybe, as Ben suggests, don't get talked about as much.
You know, a couple of things. So for a decade, I sat on the Madison Planning and Zoning Commission. And one of the things, if you sort of imagine yourself sitting at that table every Thursday night and five houses on the street have been built, and now you're going to tell the sixth house because of an incremental climate change that today is the day you say no to that house. Mm. Who makes that decision on a fairness piece? But on the broader point, I wanted to talk about what Ben said regarding the change of homes if they get destroyed. I was at a meeting of zoning enforcement officers. And a woman from a coastal town said, you know, one of the issues is that you're seeing these homes that are rebuilt as you're now increasing the base level elevation. Basically, you're jacking the house up. You said it just right. Come forward. There's federal assistance for that. And she said, how horrible. one home, and the home she gave was one that actually didn't wasn't zoning compliant as built, that if I would have had that money, I could have improved the whole street. I could have, instead of doing it house by house, I could have put in better drainage. I could have raised the seawall along the road. I could have put in swales. But instead, the money is going to build one home. So we have this mismatch in an attempt to try and help individual homeowners. We're hurting whole communities.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about building along the shoreline, building individual homes, and also entirely new communities in some cases with Alexander Felsen from Yale. We'll continue our conversation with Joe McDougald and Peter Kochenberger. They're both from the UConn School of Law. We're talking about climate change and insurance. And if you have questions, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Climate change is something that's on all of our minds. And right now we're talking about climate change specifically and insurance. Insurance companies have taken a lead on trying to figure out how to mitigate some of the problems of climate change because they're the ones seeing the frontline impacts. We're talking with Joseph McDougald, who's a professor in residence and executive director for the Center for Energy and Environmental Law at the UConn School of Law, just down the street from us. Also from UConn Law is Peter Kochenberger, who's an associate clinical professor of law and executive director of the Insurance Law Center there. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Want to bring into the conversation Alexander Felsen, who's assistant professor in the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and Yale School of Architecture. He's been working on some of these issues, including community coastal resilience plans for places like Guilford. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex. I appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
You've been listening to some of this conversation. I guess the first thing is from where you're sitting, we've been talking about just recently building individual buildings versus building entire communities, how we think about the built environment along our shorelines so as to try to address some of these issues that the professors have been talking about. What are some things that come to your mind as we enter into this conversation?
Sure, thanks. One of the points, I think, going back to a comment made about loss of value on properties on the coast, is that, you know, at the municipal scale, there are debates and discussions going on about how to think holistically and how to take into account the tax base and the function of the town, including existing homeowners and future potential home buyers. And I think, you know, the question is really how to orchestrate this transition and a kind of accommodation over time that can have the least damage and the least negative impact while having value and function for the town. And I think those kinds of questions are not easily solved because you have decision makers working at the individual household scale making decisions, where these kinds of challenges and problems are at larger scales.
Well, one of the things we were just talking about actually during the break is this question of insurance being a community of risk. And every time we talk about any community, we have to define what the community is. And Alex, from where you sit, what are we talking about when we're talking about various communities that might be impacted by climate change? I mean, sometimes the governmental agencies are town by town, but, you know, the Eastern Seaboard that got affected by Superstorm Sandy is, well, it's many, many thousands of miles worth of various communities. How do you define the community?
Okay, so, I mean, Connecticut's interesting because it's a glacial landscape. There's really, you know, the terrain is kind of hills and valleys. And so the risk areas end up being very patchy. And we're calling it, rather than calling it neighborhoods, we're thinking of zones of shared risk or areas of land where neighbors and homeowners share similar risks. Sometimes that's an egress. Sometimes that's, you know, being on the coast and facing potential wave damage. And the idea is, the notion is how, since it's such a complicated problem and it's not just an insurance issue, it's a variety of issues from infrastructure and egress and access. And how can you get local community members to participate in a planning process and a visioning process to try to come up with solutions that are, you know, that are viable, given that we have too much risk and not enough funding to support it, and it's, you know, multi-jurisdictional.
So I'll ask our insurance experts here. I mean, how exactly do these two things overlay, these communities of risk that Alex is talking about based on the terrain and what you might actually see as far as a flooding situation, and then the actual town boundaries of 169 communities? I mean, how much overlap is there?
So one of the nice things about Alex's work is that what he's done is he's looked at patches along the coast and said, we don't have 169 problems. Even on the coast, we don't have 32 problems. Maybe we have 10. And there's just a big advantage. Now, you're right. They don't overlap the municipal boundaries. The coast of Guilford and the coast of Madison, the ocean doesn't really pay attention to where the boundary hits. But at least if you can chunk them together, maybe you can say, among this common problem, what are the best ways to look at the development over a long scale, 20 years, 25 years, differently? Maybe we don't just have a coastal zone and the zone right behind it. Maybe we have the next zone behind it where we're going to encourage more people to build, but not so much right in the most dangerous areas. But it's not the whole coast either. It's a more granular and I think a better view as to how you can look at it.
And I think, and also how you define the community of risk is also who makes the decision. So that, you know, the risk, it's also a political community, and that can be a real problem. So we have tens of thousands of different building codes in the United States. We have the fact that insurance is regulated largely by the states, which means Connecticut and Massachusetts and South Carolina can make some very different decisions about what the rates will be on the shore or anywhere else. And then we also have the federal government, which currently is the operator of the flood insurance plan, and they make different decisions. So the federal government's community of risk isn't Madison. Or Connecticut, it's the country as a whole.
You know, one thing to think about, so compare the coast of Connecticut to the Outer Banks of North Carolina.
Sure.
A place I vacation and love very dearly. But North Carolina, by state action, there is no sea level rise in North Carolina. In case you're wondering, it's a state law. Connecticut, on the other hand, has formed a group to look at it.
It'd be nice if you just take care of it by just passing a law, right?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Say there's no sea level rise. There's no sea level
rise. Climate change. There's no. You know, we outlaw climate change.
And they say legislators don't do anything. They solved it in North Carolina.
Yes.
But yet the community of risk on those coastal properties is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So here we are in Connecticut. We're putting money into it. We're looking at our places. Other areas won't even look at the enhanced rate of it, yet right now our community of risk is identical.
Well, and I just have to say, and before I get back to something about buildings with Alex that I think is very important to this, it does strike you that if we're talking about this entire country and we're talking about places, frankly, that will never, ever be flooded and maybe are very safe from the effects of climate change, and we think about places like Florida or North Carolina that both are very impacted by climate change, but seem to have some sort of a community idea that it's not existing at all. It does complicate things, doesn't it? I mean, we're all here working together theoretically at the same problem and paying rates based on some of the same federal models, but yet we're approaching this problem so incredibly differently. Again, it somehow doesn't seem fair, does it?
Well, no. And the North Carolina example is great because if North Carolina doesn't allow consideration of climate change and set in, you know, in looking at flood zones within at least in the state level and pricing, then they're making a decision that ultimately we all are going to pay for. And it's not only a national community, and to some extent it's international.
Sure.
So what, you know, insurance companies buy insurance, reinsurance. Those companies are global. So the cost of insurance in the United States depends in a small amount, you know, for individuals on what disasters have happened worldwide, because reinsurance companies operate worldwide. So the ability of an insurance company, you know, so the cost of my homeowner's insurance depends in part on my insurance company. Can it get reinsurance? And that is going to be affected worldwide.
So I guess the political question, maybe it's a business question, is, Joe, can the fact that, say, a Swiss reinsurance company that has very big stake in America, can they actually start to force, much like we've seen over the course of the last week or so, an awful lot of people putting pressure on the state of Indiana after they passed a law that a lot of people don't like? Well, all of a sudden, maybe you're not going to go to Indiana now. Maybe this law is going to change. Can a big, you know, multinational company come down to Florida or North Carolina and say, you know what? You really need to do things differently, guys, because we have a stake in this too.
You know, I think the good news, sometimes when you talk about climate change, you end up in a conversation like, ugh. You know, it has this weight on you.
I've had lots of those.
Yeah, but here's a good reason for optimism in that the insurance problem, because I think we even talk about it and they recognize it's broad. It's not just flood that's northeast. It's droughts in California. It's the snow we've had tied in with a very warm, surprisingly, January, that they're starting to look at it and say it's not just storm damage. It's crop damage. It's dislocation. There's Emery Lovins, who is a big thinker in this area, said we should never have called it global warming. It should be global weirding. And if you look at it that way, things are changing. The law is static, but the climate isn't, and it's moving. So insurance companies are really good at looking across a lot of sectors of the economy. And to your point, they can now affect a lot of sectors when it comes to transportation, microgrids, electricity. These are things that really weren't in the conversation 10 years ago, and they are today. And that's good news.
Yeah. And it's not so much that Swiss Re, with great example, can come and tell you what to do, but what they, you know, I'm a homeowner. I want to get insurance. The cost, you know, if the cost of my insurance is going to, you know, depend on what, say, what State Farm or Travelers, that to some extent is going to depend on the ability of Swiss Re, the willingness to say, yes, we'll insure it. So it's sort of this, it's a private sector mechanism to say, you know, while Swiss Re or Travelers can't tell the state of North Carolina what to do, they can decide not to write insurance in that area.
And they can ask for resilience plans of the businesses in those towns
states. Which is an important thing. Stand by for a second. I want to bring Alex Felsen back into the conversation because we've been talking a lot about some of the localized impacts of climate change having to do with communities or different areas, different topography. But the building is a big piece of this, too. We had the homeowner Ben call up from Stonington saying, you know, one of the issues is the home gets knocked down. If you want to rebuild, you got to build it up on stilts, get it up a certain height. Alex, what can you tell us about ways beyond just moving houses a little higher up? People are thinking about building or rebuilding so that you can actually have homes in these high-risk places that are going to withstand storms and are going to be, frankly, insurable into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so to go into that, I mean, I'm working right now on the Guilford Coastal Resilience Plan with Malone McBroom and the Nature Conservancy. And, you know, that kind of community-based planning process creates discussion that I think may not otherwise exist and creates a forum for debate between homeowners and the municipalities around these kinds of issues. So if nothing else, I think there's a great value to those kinds of planning processes to get these kinds of debates and concerns, like the fellow from Stonington, his concern that he raised. So, in terms of the, I think it's important for property owners not just to think about their homes, but to think about the land that they're on and the location and the roadway network that connects to their homes. We're looking at topography and we're looking at egress options, and we're trying to figure out ways in which we can essentially maintain some of the home, maintain homes in coastal areas and have options for emergency egress where needed, or for accessibility where they might work at their where they might elevate at some point and control some of the flood damage while still maintaining those properties. There are other issues like wind damage that I've been hearing about. Talking to Milford, they have Milford's gotten into the community rating system program. And so they have, I think they're a class 9, which gives them gives insurance policyholders an automatic 5% deduction on their premiums. And the community rating system is essentially a community planning tool that encourages smart growth and smart development. I think at the homeowner scale and along the coastal areas, there's an opportunity to think about green infrastructure and drainage systems and water management. So really taking advantage of your property location and figuring out ways of, let's say, maybe setbacks to accommodate marsh advancement and other kinds of negotiating strategies that could consider not just the property, but the property in its context.
And these ideas of more natural absorption of what's happening coming off the ocean, as opposed to just, putting up a seawall to keep it from hitting our house, that you're actually using nature itself to start to mitigate some of these problems, Alex.
Yeah, the individual, wall in front of someone's house doesn't take into consideration where your building is in your neighbors and your context and what the implications of that will have on the surrounding area. And it also doesn't really take into consideration long-term planning. So, yeah, we've been pushing, living shorelines and other kinds of strategies that might allow for increased ecosystem function, potentially increased recreation along coastal areas. If we take a proactive approach to accommodating sea level rise, we can actually turn it into a way of improving communities, improving, access, improving the value of our coastal ecosystems, and hopefully if you think about the egresses and parking issues and making sure that during an emergency event that there is that the system is functioning, which goes back to the point about thinking about the upland, not just the coastal areas, but how do we connect the upland areas down to the coasts and vice versa. Those kinds of larger scale regional planning are critical. And when you think about programs like, you know, Connecticut DOT and where they're spending money on road improvements and other kinds of investments, if we can prioritize or connect those kinds of projects and development projects with adaptation solutions and egress options, you know, then we're not just spending money here and there ad hoc. We might have a more cohesive approach to retrofitting coastal areas.
Alexander Felsen is an assistant professor in the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and Yale School of Architecture. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I also want to thank Joseph McDougald and Peter Kochenberger. They both joined us from the UConn School of Law to talk about this really important issue. I'd like to have you guys back and talk a little bit more about this because there's so much more to discuss. Thank you for coming into Where We Live.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk with Susan Campbell. She's been doing a series for us about the 100-Day Challenge, trying to end chronic homelessness in Greater Hartford. We're going to get an update and a story from her about how hard it is to get identification when you don't have a place to call home. That's next Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, last week the Affordable Care Act marked its fifth anniversary, meaning it's time for us to do another health care check-in. It's also tax time, and there are big implications there to explore around the ACA. We will look at a Supreme Court case that is challenging Obamacare tax credits, and we'll get the latest on our own health insurance exchange. Hope you can join us for that conversation coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. We've been working with writer Susan Campbell on a project tracking the 100-Day Challenge in the Greater Hartford area meant to end chronic homelessness in our region. The idea isn't as far-fetched as it may sound. It's meant to focus extreme effort on assisting chronically homeless people like Sal Pinna, who Susan has been profiling for us. In a few moments, we'll get an update on the 100-Day Challenge. But first, Susan tells us a story about one very important hurdle, getting proper identification when you don't have any official paperwork or a place to call home.
It's a bitter cold Friday in March, and Sal Pinna is heading into the wind on Main Street in Hartford.
Cold enough, but I don't feel a thing. I guess I'm used to it.
Pinna, a Long Island native, has been homeless for 20 years in Connecticut, but he wants very much to get an apartment. He has in his backpack a Xerox copy of his birth certificate, but that's not good enough for official paperwork. Without proper identification, Pinna is stuck in shelters or worse. For a while, he slept rough, out on the streets in the cold and wind. He doesn't want to do that again. Today he's heading to the Social Security office in Hartford's graceful old G. Fox building to apply for a Social Security card. He needs adequate identification in order to be housed. He needs to be what advocates call document ready. This is, he says, his third time going to the office.
I got a nice hoodie sweatshirt on.
Where do you get your clothes?
I get it at the shelter.
They give you clothes?
Yeah, they have a clothing line.
Okay. You find stuff that fit okay?
Yeah. This is where I found this jacket.
This looks warm.
It is. Because the jacket reminded me of a jacket my mother once got me for Christmas.
For real? So what are we doing right now?
We're waiting to go inside the Social Security office.
After waiting his turn, a polite woman calls Pinna back to her desk. She listens to Pinna's frustrated retelling of his inability to get a card. She explains that he should have received his replacement card weeks ago. When he tells her he has been living in a shelter, she says the card may have been mailed there but not forwarded to him. She suggests he start the process again. An hour later, Pinna leaves without a Social Security card, though he does get the process going. He is told he must return to a clinic he visits and get a proof of identification there. He promises to do so.
Well, it becomes very difficult to get one type of document if you don't have any other documents.
Heather Pilarczyk is South Park Inn's service coordinator for women and families, and she was unanimously chosen team leader for the Greater Hartford 100-Day Challenge team.
So if someone has had their wallet lost or stolen and you imagine having to replace all of those things, where do you start? If it's been years since you've had any kind of a photo identification or a permanent address, if you're not in touch with family members that may be able to get that type of document for you, it's very difficult to start at square one and prove that you are who you say you are.
Penn is not alone in his frustration to prove he is who he says he is. The leadership team of the 100-Day Challenge has a spreadsheet with clients and what identification they have and what they need. This is a new approach. The team knows these people who are homeless, and they know them by name. Heather Pilarczyk.
Well, the hope is that for those folks that are the most vulnerable, this type of intervention is really life-changing and potentially life-saving. Many of these folks experience very significant physical or mental illnesses. They've been involved in very risky and dangerous behaviors that are most likely to result in some sort of trauma or potential loss of life to them. We think it's important to address those needs and to make sure that those people are taken care of.
Given the importance of identification, the Harford team also set the goal of getting 200 people document ready. Organizers are planning what they're calling a document fair in May that will include people from Social Security, the Department of Motor Vehicles, and other places who will devote a day to getting people, some of whom have been off the grid for decades, the proper identification. The fair is an innovative way to deal with a long-time snag in the system, getting people IDs.
This 100 days is meant to inspire working together in a way that best serves these clients, this population, and can really assist folks in transitioning from homelessness into permanent housing as quickly as possible.
Meanwhile, Pinna got his Social Security card, and he's working on getting more important paperwork completed, including a 5-page document that verifies that he is, in fact, homeless. His texts come in frequently. He says, "How long will it take till I get my own place?" He says, "I have to get out of this place." He says, "I want to live normal again."
That's Susan Campbell reporting for us here on Where We Live. She's doing a series for us on homelessness, and we're checking in on the 100-Day Challenge in the greater Hartford area. Susan joins us in the studio now. Susan, thanks for the story, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John.
It's surprising to a lot of us for whom ID is just something that comes naturally, that it's this big a struggle. It's amazing to hear, and it's so important for people like Sal.
It is incredibly important. If you do not have the proper identification, you don't have a shot at being housed.
Mm. And Sarah Solomons came in as well with Susan. She's development consultant at Journey Home CT. And Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
So this 100-day challenge that Susan has been following, part of it is getting IDs for people. Part of it is identifying the homeless population. But the real thrust is to try to end this chronic homelessness problem. Can you maybe give us an update on where we are right now?
Well, we are at day 22 officially with the 100-day campaign, and we are working tirelessly to identify the folks that are eligible for housing. And at this point, we've matched about 15 potential people to open slots. So we're on our way.
And when you say open slots in what sort of housing? Explain.
It's different kinds of housing. So often it's permanent supportive housing. So we're looking at positive exit, and that is our goal, is positive exit out of homelessness.
So Susan, in her story and just now, said something very, very important, this whole idea of paperwork. You really can't get yourself into a home if you don't have the proper paperwork. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Most housing programs typically require certain types of documentation, whether that be a photo ID, Social Security card, benefit statements, income statements. So regardless, they often do require documentation. And so part of what we, our work at Journey Home, is to work with these housing programs to limit the amount of documentation that is required, because different programs require different sorts of documentation. But the reality is that there will always be a need for documentation. So what we're faced with is helping people access those documents. And I just want to maybe give you an example of someone who has nothing. So, and this is not an unlikely scenario in our society. They have no birth certificate, no photo identification, they don't have a Social Security card, and they're really starting at square one. And this is, like I said, this is not uncommon. A lot of folks are faced with this dilemma because they've been moving from shelter to shelter, and they've lost things along the way, or they've, you know, been a victim of theft. So they have to start at square one. And starting at square one means obtaining a birth certificate. And in order to obtain a birth certificate, you need an ID. And if you don't have an ID, the state has provided a list of documents that could potentially work to prove your identification. So there's a list of 16 potential documents, and then you would need to provide two of those documents. Mm. But those are things like a Social Security card, a vehicle registration, a utility bill. So clearly, these folks don't have those things.
And it's this big circle. And Susan, I wonder, because as we try to solve the very specific problem of getting people the identification that they need to get this done, there's maybe a larger public policy discussion. I mean, what do you think needs to change to make this a little bit easier? What could make it so that Sal or the person that Sarah's talking about might be able to get identification more readily?
I think just from the get-go, the systems have to be set up to be more consumer-friendly. The system as it's set up now has occurred over time, and there are layers of policies that probably worked at one point. But I think what the 100-day challenge is, and Sarah can correct me if I'm wrong, is a big part of that is taking that system, looking at it, and stripping it down and creating a system where you don't have this impossible circle where you can't possibly get yourself identified properly.
Yeah, in over the course of 100 days, as I said in my introduction, it seems like an awful lot of work. But you're making headway on some of these things. Do you feel like you're going to be able to get to some of your goals by the end of the 100 days?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely believe that we will get to some of these goals. I mean, we are, as Susan mentioned in the first story, we are having this document fair on May 8th at the Chrysalis Center just down the street here. And we are inviting a number of different organizations, the Social Security, the DMV, CCSD, Adult Probation, the Hartford Town Clerk, to come and to be part of this document fair, which, when we have folks coming, then they will be able to gain immediate access to these very needed documents. So Friday, May 8th at Chrysalis Center, 10 to 2. And we're hoping that some of these barriers will be broken down during that time.
Just to give you an indication of the way people are approaching this more innovatively, I heard at a meeting yesterday that was it a Hartford Hospital?
Yes.
Has said that they will be there for anyone who was born in Hartford Hospital. They'll be there to identify. St. Francis has been asked. I don't know if they've responded, but that's a really interesting way to approach it. Here's your documentation.
And this idea of a fair, I mean, it's so very important because any of us know that waiting in line and going through bureaucracy, no matter our circumstance, can be difficult. But if you put everything in one place and say, okay, here's a chance for you to get all the documents you need, this might be the only chance that people really have, right?
With people to walk those people through the process.
There will be navigators on site who will help folks and walk them through this.
And we just have about 30 seconds or so, but that's a part of what Journey Home is doing, is really helping people navigate through the system, right?
Absolutely. It's all about breaking down barriers and creating a consumer-friendly environment for folks.
Yeah. Well, Sarah Solomon, I really wish you the best of luck in
this.
And we're going to be checking back with you and see how things are going. But I appreciate it. And again, give us the date of this event.
Friday, May 8th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Chrysalis Center on Homestead Avenue in Hartford.
We'll put more information on our website. Sarah Solomon is the development consultant at Journey Home CT. Susan Campbell is a columnist who's back to writing a column for the Hartford Current. And she's also writing for us here at WNPR. In a couple of weeks, again, we'll have the next in her series on homelessness in Connecticut as we track this 100-day challenge. Thanks again so much, Susan.
Thank you, John.
Our program today produced by Lydia Brown and our executive producer, Katie Talarski. Thanks also to Betsy Kaplan, Tucker Ives, and Kyone Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our interns today, Julia Pistel and Kelsey Bissell. Continue this conversation online, WNPR.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.